My name is Jean, for those I've not yet met. Thank you for coming and setting aside this time to be with each other in Sangha. In Buddhism, we talk about various sets of numbers, and I would like to talk about several sets of numbers this evening. One is that we find we bow three times quite often. Lots of number three happens in Buddhism. Excuse me. So when we're bowing three times, we're bowing for and with the triple treasure, which we recognize as Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. And this is Buddha as the person in history who lived, but also what we might call the formless. So let me get into the numbers of this now. We have three, but then sometimes we do nine. So that nine is three times three, that's obvious. And what is that times three? One way to think about it is realms. We have a formless realm, a form realm, and the realm of intention. So let's see if I'm able to follow this through so that you can follow it logically. The Buddha of the formless realm is none other than your own true self. And the Dharma of the formless realm is reality as it is, ever changing, and the teachings about reality as it is. And the Sangha of the formless realm, this one being in complete interconnection with every other being, completely incomprehensible, really, to the human mind. We could call that the formless realm because it's so vast and wide. Then we have the Buddha of the form realm, who actually lived and taught, learned, figured something out, and shared that with his companions, and has been being shared throughout the millennia since that time. That's the form realm. The Dharma of the form realm, we could call the thousands of books and poems and lectures that have been offered, the Dharma of the form realm, a way of trying to give us all access to the teachings about reality as it is. And the Sangha of the form realm, well, here we are in our bodies together. And we can think of this as our own bodies in this place and time, and every other follower of the Buddha throughout space and time. So now we've done six bows. Buddha, Dharma, Sangha in formless. Buddha, Dharma, Sangha in form. And now the third set of three, the realm of intention. At the end of lecture, we chant these vows. You'll recognize them. So the intention realm of Buddha, we say, I vow to become Buddha's way. That's the intention to live this way through compassion and loving kindness, for example. The Dharma of the intention realm, we say, Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them all. And the Sangha of the intention realm, we say, delusions are numberless. I vow to end them. And we do this in service of were for the benefit of all beings. This is the Sangha realm. These vows are quite connected to our intention. It's a way of expressing our deepest desire. So that's a little tour of the three and of the nine. I would also like to talk tonight about 108 and the 108 delusions in particular. I have found myself lately, I guess I would say arguing with myself, getting positional and opinionated. There's a lot to be opinionated about right now in our social and public sphere. So I thought I would share with you a little bit about how I work with what I call delusions. But first, let me give you the number study of the delusions. How do we get to 108? You know, on New Year's Eve, we ring 108 bells. And in the mala that sometimes people wear, 108 beads. What is this 108? There's nothing really magic about it. It's just a way to think. It's a structure to think into, nothing more. So what is the 108? In Buddhism, we have what we call the six senses. You know, a little contrasting with the Western European version of five, eyes, ears, nose, tongue, touch. In Buddhism, we have six, and the sixth one is mind. Briefly, I have the eye organ and the visible world. When the eye organ meets the visible world, we call that seeing. When the ear organ meets the auditory world, we call that hearing, and so on, for each eyes, ears, nose, tongue, touch, and mind. When the mind is busy with a memory or an analysis or a prediction, we call this thinking. This is the activity of mind. So the six senses and six sense fields in their activity. And then they have their activity in another set of six that we could call the six realms of existence. So six times six, 36. And I'll give you what the realms of existence are. One of them is the realm of the Titans. The Titans are all of these realms are allegorically a way to refer to our own internal landscape. They're not figures that actually exist out in the new sphere somewhere. They're allegory for understanding our own human activity. So the Titans, when I'm feeling blustery and kind of larger than life, I'm in my realm of being a Titan, kind of pushing my weight around, either by age or position or by color. I'm demanding some attention based on what I perceive as my status to be large. I'm a Titan. Then we also have the animal realm. I spoke to you not long ago about the animal realm of goats. The animal realm of just the physical response to the world. We all know what it's like to walk around, maybe in the forest or out in nature often, and all of our senses immediately, occasionally become on alert. You know, there is some sense of danger and our human mind can't quite pick out what it is, but something in us has triggered, you know, even the hair on the back of our neck stands up. You felt that feeling. The heart begins to race. The ears and eyes become particularly attentive to detail. This is the animal realm. And when I watch my dog, for example, get on alert, the whole ruff of her neck sticks out. We actually have little hairs on our own necks. when we're afraid, our ruffs stick out too. That's what, when a hair on the back of our neck stands up, we're in the animal realm. Okay, titans, animals. Oh yes, then we have the realm of our own internal landscape that feels undernourished. In Buddhism, we call this the realm of the hungry ghosts. They're often depicted human figures, human-ish figures, with very thin throats so that they can't actually absorb the nourishment that is being offered to them, or swallow it. So we all have a sense of what it feels like to be undernourished or unseen. Another realm, of course, is the human realm. And we just live in that on a day-to-day basis. We all know what that feels like. The realm of relationship, the realm of family, of society, of culture. Then we have a heavenly realm. We might think of this as a blissful feeling. There's nothing wrong with pleasure and bliss. And because it feels so good, we would like to hang out there for a long time. So in the heavenly realm, one of the dangers is that it's passive, because we'd like to hang there and just feel how delicious that is. So in the heavenly realm, it's a little bit mistaken, because even that changes, even though we would like it to not change. When things are good, you know, we want them to stay that way. And we're unhappy when it changes. When things are crummy, we're glad when it changes. Doesn't matter how we feel about it, it's going to change anyway. And then the sixth realm is the hell realm. We all know what that feels like. It's like whatever is the most difficult, challenging, either physical or emotional state of being that we can find ourselves in is called a hell realm. We all know what that feels like. So now, 6 times 6 is 36. Let me see if I can give you a couple of examples. So in the realm of titans, taking up more space than is my allotted space. And if, so, let's see if I can, the realm of titans and eyes, the realm of titans and ears, the realms of titans and smell, the realm of titan and taste, the realm of titan and touch, the realm of titan and mind. So, that's the realm. Okay, so we got six there. So for example, the realm of titan and taste, completely enjoying this food, feeling like this food could just go on forever for me, and then when I associate this with a sense of wanting more. Now I've brought in the three, we call them poisons. I don't really like that word, but I'm going to use it for now. You have a sense of 6 times 6. 6 times 6 times 3, 108. Isn't that great? So the six realms of existence times the six senses and six sense fields. And what are the three? Greed, hate, and delusion. Isn't the math of that cool? So let me see if I can give you some examples. The realm of titan and taste, with the poison of greed, is going to lead me to the overconsumption of food. So what's deluded about that, here's one of the delusions, one of the 108, What's deluded about that is that I have forgotten that I'm interconnected. Other people need food too. You know, I have forgotten something about one of the three truths. Mm-hmm. All right, another example. If I am in the animal realm and in the realm and in the sphere of mind with the particular poison, I hate the word hatred, aversion, let's use aversion, okay. Animal realm, mind, and the activity of aversion, what's likely to happen is I feel defensive, I feel, you know, like lashing out, that's the animal realm. And in my mind, I've decided that someone else is wrong and I am right. And in the sense of aversion, what's likely to happen is that I'm going to lash out to somebody verbally. I'm unlikely to physically fight, but some people would physically fight in the animal realm when the mind gets activated in aversion, right? So, one more. If I'm in the heavenly realm, it's blissful, pleasant. I want to stay here forever, imagining that it might be some kind of pleasant touch. And now, with the activity of ignorance, forgetting that things are impermanent, I imagine I might be able to stay in this blissful state and always be happy and always be satisfied. That's a delusion. We know it's going to change. So, I won't give you 108 examples. That would be incredibly boring, but I encourage you to figure out on your own how do these six realms of existence and the six senses and sense fields along with greed, hate, and delusion, how do they interact? So, that's what the 108 is about. You can use that as a way to examine your own internal landscape. Mm-hmm. Nothing more. The 108, especially on a mala, is often worn on the non-dominant hand as a way of bringing mindfulness to that arm and hand to make sure that it's included in activity, stay balanced. Mm-hmm. For example, when Yoshi taught calligraphy here, he had us work with our dominant hand in the brush, of course. And the non-dominant hand was actively involved by being a stable place in front of the artist. Mm-hmm. So, and then he had us work with our non-dominant hand and the brush, and the dominant hand was the stable one. I find that my calligraphy is much better with my non-dominant hand. Because my left hand doesn't care how it turns out. My left hand is just moving. My right hand wants to be controlling. Much better calligraphy, a lot more flow in my left-handed calligraphy. Okay, so some people wear a mala on their non-dominant hand as a way of making sure that it stays active so that the body itself stays balanced. It's really just a tool. The 108 can be a counter during zazen. For me, it takes about 3 trips around the 108 to make a 40-minute period. One breath. It's simply a way of staying focused. Mm-hmm. So back to these three things that we call poisons. They're really just mistakes. Because what we've mistakenly believed is that for, at least momentarily believed, that for our limited view is true and correct. So when we talk about greed, for example, as a poison. Mm-hmm. we're maybe at the physical level trying to acquire things that would elevate our status, either our own self-esteem or our status in view of someone else, you know? Greed, acquiring stuff, just stuff. Perhaps the most stylish clothes or something in that realm, acquiring belongings. That is greed at work. It can take a lot of different forms. Basically, it is a way of trying to elevate one's status. It puts us at odds with other human beings, actually, because other human beings, naturally being human, are also trying to elevate their own status. So all of a sudden now there's a kind of competition that goes along with this sense of greed. Greed might be too strong a word. I would imagine that none of us is greedy in that way. And I know that I can be very self-serving. So we kind of pull apart at the nuance level. Where are we self-serving or putting our own needs as primary? We have a precept that says, a disciple of Buddha does not praise self at the expense of another. A wise person has taught me, praising self is always at the expense of another. We don't actually need the second part of that phrase. But we say it in order to highlight, oh yes, when I have put my own needs as primary, it's likely that someone else is being left out. So it's a way to broaden our view, to become inclusive rather than divisive. Okay. For a moment now, aversion. Because we have a tendency as a deluded human to see ourselves as separate from others, we judge things to be either desirable or we want to turn away from these things. If we're above others or better than others, we want to turn away from that which we consider lesser than. And we're also likely to be angry with anyone who gets between us and what it is we desire. It all stems from believing that we are separate. So these are often spoken as greed, hatred, and delusion, or we could say self-importance, aversion, and ignorance. But the truth is that ignorance should be first. Because if we're ignorant of, or for a moment even ignoring the fact that we already know that we are interconnected and things will change, if we are ignorant of these two truths, we're more likely to experience aversion and more likely to experience self-elevation. Ignorance is the root of the other two, basically. So you've got 6 times 6 as 36 times 3, greed, hate, and delusion. That makes 108. It sounds like, oh, there's no possible hope. 108, I'm stuck. Another way to say talk about the 108 is simply a lot. For example, we can picture 3 birds. It's easy to picture 3 birds. It's fairly easy to picture 8 or 9 turtles, because they move slowly. 9 turtles, I can see them, you know, I can visualize that. It's harder to visualize 9 cats, because they move quickly. But 108 is a number that we can't actually easily visualize. Yeah? So it's another way of just saying a lot. Somewhere in our literature, there's also a reference to 84,000 delusions, which is another way of saying beyond comprehension, a lot. So, with ignorance being one of the roots of suffering, when we reinforce and encourage our delusions, we're adding to suffering for ourselves and others. And when we're able to intervene in our delusions, we're tipping toward wholesome activity. And please understand that I mean to say that these delusions are normal, natural. We can't get rid of them. We can resolve them, but they're not gone, because being human, we have the realm of habit that we work in. So, for example, somewhere in our literature, there's this figure called an ogre, monstrous figure. Might think of it as a titan and an animal combined. An ogre. I can find my own internal ogre. Can you find yours? It's probably not too far away. So in our literature, we have someone called a red ogre. And the red ogre, being an ogre, got its nourishment from eating living beings. That's what ogres do. And at some point, this ogre became inspired by the activity of the bodhisattvas around them and decided, being an ogre, that it would eat a bodhisattva in order to become more like a bodhisattva. And apparently in the story, that's exactly what happened. So the ogre didn't have to stop being an ogre. Just set the intention to be more like these other beings that they admired. In this same way, we don't have to not have our delusions. We just slowly, over time, transmute them into wholesome activity. In Foundations class, I've been speaking about it this way. The training of Zazen, this activity of sitting quietly and stilling the body and mind, counting breaths, is a training activity. And it's a training for being able to identify what I've started to call that micro moment when an impulse would take us down a divisive path and we transmute that into the activity of a wholesome path. With practice, we're able to catch that moment before the unwholesome or divisive activity leaks. Eiken Roshi talks about this way. In a passage where he's talking about the core delusion, we desire permanent existence for ourselves and for our loved ones, and we desire to prove ourselves independent of others and superior to them. These desires conflict with the way things are. Nothing abides. Everything and everyone depends upon everything and everyone else. This conflict causes our anguish, and we project this anguish on those we meet. When we catch that moment of conflict, we're able to kind of stop the leak. We're able to kind of intervene in the habitual. I would say that's what we're busy learning how to do when we're in seated zazen. We know that zazen doesn't end when we walk out the door, actually. The fruit of zazen reveals itself when we begin our interactions with the more active world. We see, oh yeah, that moment, I get it. And the activity of zazen is such a body activity that we identify, oh right, the greed of my Titan lives there. When I feel that activity in that place of my body, I know I need to have a response that's wholesome. We chant the Heart Sutra on a daily basis. And these egocentric attitudes, I would call them, positions that we hold that are self-serving, are what the Heart Sutra calls inverted views. In some translations, perverted views, or in some translation, topsy-turvy views. Basically, it's an upside-down way of looking at things. So this activity of identifying our topsy-turvy views and putting them upright, inverting them, is the activity of practice. It's a tall order to say, delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to extinguish them all. And yet we say that. It's impossible. And we bring ourselves back to that activity again and again. This is the gift of the Sangha jewel. In the company of like-intentioned friends, we can practice these skills. It's easy to apologize amongst trusted friends. Oh, I'm sorry. Can we try that again? Like children on a playground tapping on the four square. Take over. Can we do that again? It's easy to do that amongst trusted friends. It's harder to do that when we're out in the very active part of our life. So what we're doing in Sangha is offering each other the opportunity to release our self-deception. You know, some of the teaching says that we want to rid ourselves of it. But actually what we're doing is releasing it. Releasing it, and it releases its grip on us. So what we're doing in Sangha is turning our upside-down views right side up and live in harmony with the reality as it is. I have just one more comment and then open up to your questions and comments. On a fairly regular basis, we chant here this teaching called the Metta Sutta. Metta meaning loving kindness. So this is the teaching on loving kindness. And the context for that is that loving kindness is kind of the, I would call it an antidote to this self-serving nature that we have. To turn our attention to someone else and offer our time or our energy. So this teaching on loving kindness begins with this couple of sentences. This is what should be accomplished by the one who is wise, who seeks the good and has obtained peace. Let one be strenuous, upright, and sincere, without pride, easily contented and joyous. That teaching goes on quite a bit. This is from the Buddha, and it was offered, I understand, in this context, that there were his disciples, monks and nuns, were arguing with some village people. The village people didn't want them sleeping where they were sleeping, apparently on top of the graves of their elders. So the village people went to the Buddha's, you know, scolding, basically. You have to tell your people to honor our elders. You have to tell them how to respect what we're asking of them. So this Metta Sutta is what the Buddha taught in response. This is what should be accomplished by the one who is wise, who seeks the good and has obtained peace. Let one be strenuous, upright, and sincere, without pride, easily contented and joyous. I found a translation of this that is someone calling it a literal translation. They took both the Sanskrit and the Pali and took the exact words into English without having it be as poetic as the one we typically recite. Pretty close, but there are some subtle differences, and I want to point out the biggest difference that really kind of caught me in the gut. This is what ought to be done, this is what ought to be done by one skilled in the good, having understood the path to peace, able, straightforward and straight up, polite, they should be mild and not arrogant. Mm-hmm. So this teaching on loving kindness, I think, has something to tell us about our activity in contemporary social issues related to race, for example, related to gender, class, any of the other things that we think divide us, political party affiliation, for example. We think of these as places that cause division. And this teaching is asking us to be gentle, upright, and sincere, not arrogant. What is the activity of seeing the delusion and feeling the choice point to tip toward inclusion rather than division? Maybe we can have some conversation about that. Where do you feel your delusions kind of raising their heads? And what are the choice points for you when you would rather tip toward the vow? Is that question too big? Yes. Yes.
I think one of the indicators is being aware of the activation of my verbal commentary. Realizing that there's a story, that there's a storytelling that's going on.
Yes.
And it's usually accompanied with a physiological agitation.
Uh-huh.
And so the trick, the practice is not to be seduced by that. Because there's a way that it feels good. It's like a relief, you know, to think bad thoughts about people that I'm mad at.
Yeah.
It makes me feel, I think, feel better.
Yeah.
And that is a trap.
Yes. So that, let me see if I can put it in the language of the delusions of 108. That wish to fight, basically, is an animal realm. The animal realm with the activity of the mind that's creating a narrative.
Yeah.
So recognizing that, the agitation itself is telling you, oh, this is probably a delusion. Where can I interrupt? If you want to interrupt, it's a choice. You can choose. Once you see the delusion, you can choose. Maybe it's totally appropriate to fight. And it's a choice rather than a habit. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, I've never done a breakdown of the realms in this way. And actually find it very helpful because I've never particularly been drawn to that interpretive math in Buddhism.
Uh-huh.
But this is a really different way to think about it.
Uh-huh. Okay. Thank you. You know, we can take the narrative that the mind is yakking away with a narrative that's creating a stronger and stronger reason why we should fight, right? Basically, that's elevating us beyond the size that we are. So in the animal realm, we have four F words. There are usually two that are spoken. They are fight and flight. I wanted to share with you the other two. One of the animal realm F words is freeze. You know, we become kind of paralyzed. We don't know what to do, what way to turn. And so we become a little bit, for my own body, I become withdrawn. And my shoulders actually kind of collapse in. Mm-hmm. That's a freeze state. And it's a natural response to trauma. The fourth F word, and animals do this within their own species usually, they make friends. They wag their tails or they begin to do the body language that would have them not appear to be threatening in any way. So the four F words, fight, flight, freeze, and friend, are an indicator that we're in the animal realm. What else? Yes, Yarrow.
Well, thinking about, you know, kind of aggression and anger, it seems like that would be the same in all the realms, that aggressive response. That, so I can't imagine, like, in the human realm or in the Titan realm, what would be the flavor of differentiation there?
Mm. Probably size. That's a guess, you know. If I'm having a normal kind of irritated reaction, I'm human. But if I'm having an outsized, no, I'm really right here, that's probably in the realm of Titan. Yeah? Something to
so
do with...
Yeah, the animal realm is sort of more physical. Mm-hmm. In a way, the whole physiology is involved more.
Mm-hmm.
And the human realm is more in your mind, like, oh, God.
Right. Yeah, ready to come on big. Yeah, and hungry ghosts would be, oh, I'm not good enough. I'll never be good enough, and I just shrink into nothing. I'm never nourished enough. Yeah. Each one of us is going to have our own way that we work with these six realms. I don't want to lay too much of mine on you. But it's not necessarily an activity for Zazen because it's super mental. Stay with the body in Zazen. Do this analysis of the six and the six some other time. Yes. Mm-hmm.
I always see humans as animals. And if we do make that distinction and separate ourselves in that way as if we are somehow different from them or superior or in any way different from, let's say, a lion is different from a turtle. Well, we're different from a lion. But to make an entire realm for us as opposed to the animal kingdom?
Yeah. All right, and you can collapse those two. That's cool. You've got five realms.
No, fine. That would be wise.
Yeah. Yes. There are those who would say that human consciousness is different than animal consciousness, and that's a point that one could take down a long road of conversation. Yeah. So for you, human realm and animal realm are one thing. You've got five.
It came and went.
Okay, came and went. It'll come back over tea, no doubt. or at 3 a.m. when the ogre is up on the rooftop. Good. Thank you very much for your attention. I hope this ends up being helpful. And as we close now with these vows, recognize that what we're doing is offering ourselves the antidote to greed, hate, and delusion. Remember? I vow to become Buddha's way. I vow to see these delusions for what they are. I vow to open and enter every Dharma gate available. And we do this for the benefit of all beings. Thank you.
Yay. Yay.